For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Red Sale, and today we're focusing on the Costa Book Awards. More than 700 books were submitted for this year's Costa Awards, which recognised the most enjoyable books in five categories: novel, debut novel, biography, poetry, and children's books. The five category winners were selected earlier this month, and from them, next week, one overall winner will be selected and crowned Costa Book of the Year, winning the author £30,000. As in previous years, Read On can bring you interviews with all those in contention. So, without further ado, the Costa Novel Award has been won by Monique Roffey for The Mermaid of Black Conch, a bittersweet love story set in a tiny Caribbean village that one reviewer has described as a fishy tale of doomed womanhood.
A mer woman. He stared at the spot of her appearance for some time. He took a good look at his spliff. Was it something real strong he smoked that morning? He shook himself and gazed hard at the sea, waiting for her to pop back up. "Come back!" he shouted into the deep greyness. The mermaid had held her head up high above the waves, and he'd seen a certain expression on her face, like she'd been studying him. He waited.
Ben Onwuke, narrating The Mermaid of Black Conch, written by Monique Roffey, who joins me now.
The Mermaid of Black Conch is a 21st century rewrite of a very ancient Taino myth where a group of women curse a younger woman into exile, into being a mermaid, and to be forever banished and cast out into the sea. And my novel starts with her being recaptured in the 1970s. I've set it in a modern time, and it then is a kind of what if we caught this mermaid and how would we take care of her kind of story.
Your mermaid is banished for being too beautiful and having too beautiful a voice by the other indigenous women of the Caribbean island that she came from thousands of years ago. And it's an example of people turning on themselves.
Well, yes. I mean, you know, when we look at our legends and myths from thousands of years ago, we see this again and again, don't we? Whether it's Caribbean mythology or European mythology, we see that we as human beings haven't evolved, and we've always been prone to jealousy and malicious behavior. And so, yeah, I wanted to give this old myth an update and give my mermaid a chance for romantic love.
And she meets and is eventually rescued by a very charming Rastafarian fisherman called David, who can't quite believe his eyes when he catches her.
Well, initially she's caught by some American fishermen who've hired a local crew, and they take her back to the jetty and they string her up, and they have monetarized her immediately and want to sell her. And David sees the mermaid when they've all basically drifted into the bar to have a drink, and he cuts her down and rescues her, and his intention is to put her back in the sea. But before he can, she starts to sort of wither away and she loses her fishiness quite quickly. And the novel is partially narrated by him in an epistolary form. So we get a kind of Cupid writing about Psyche, which flips that myth as well a bit. We get the man looking back on this event, talking about the impact of this love story that it had on his life.
You mention the narrative voices, and David writes his recollections in a wonderful laconic Creole English that is brought beautifully to life by Ben Onwuke in the audiobook version. And your mermaid's voice is brought to life equally wonderfully. She speaks in a kind of free verse, which comes from everywhere and nowhere.
I had all kinds of thoughts about her, because language and the acquisition of language is quite a big part of the book as well. So how would she speak if she hadn't spoken for thousands of years. And so, well, initially I really wanted to invent some kind of mermaid language that I would write the whole book in. But I thought that might be a bit too much of a stretch. And so I just had to think about the mermaid a lot, how she would speak. And in the end, I compromised in that she doesn't have the whole book. Her voice does appear in the book, and it's an amalgam of Caribbean Creole parlance, her own language, English. And I thought, let it come out as it comes onto the page in a kind of free verse. It was a long process of thinking and devising and writing and crossing it out and then thinking, how am I going to do this?
And the first language that she learns when she comes back to land is sign language, taught to her by a 10-year-old boy who is deaf. Mm.
Yeah. So we were pre-verbal at one point, a long time ago, when we were hunter-gatherers. We didn't have language early on. We probably grunted at each other and pointed a lot. I kind of thought, okay, this is going to be something she could pick up quite easily, which is sign language, hand language. Mm. So, yeah, she absorbs several types of language, all of which are around her. So she gets sign language quite quickly. And then she's taught standard English, but she's taught it by somebody who doesn't speak standard English. She speaks Creole English. So she's kind of learned three languages. And then, of course, her own language starts to come later on in the book.
And she is accepted by some of the people in this tiny village of Constance and threatened by others. It's her original home island from many, many years ago. But just as she was banished by jealous villagers, there are villagers who want to possess her or exploit her. And then there are villagers who will accept her for who she is. And it's a book that really pivots on the balance between otherness and acceptance.
Yes, I think that's what I'm writing towards. She gets to live again, but she's facing the same problems, which is jealousy. And I think the book also asks us, who is bad and who isn't? I mean, the Americans are so sort of obviously colonial in their interest in her and wanting to monetize her and traffic her. But the people themselves are also blinded by the possibilities of her rarity and sort of asks, okay, who isn't going to sell her? Who is above this? Who isn't going to make a buck? There is a big question there about the old thing about torture. We all think torturers are bad people, but wonder how many of us could easily succumb once we were handed the power. So there is this question there about who would cash in. And also, she's very rare and exquisitely other. And yeah, she's a great metaphor for anybody who's marginalized and doesn't fit in.
I did wonder when we have the scene of her being strung up with the other fish caught by the Americans. I had a very strong image from my sighted days of a picture of a rather smug-looking Ernest Hemingway standing by the marlin he'd just caught. And I wondered if maybe that had been an inspiration for you as well.
Very much so. So I am in some ways writing back to Ernest Hemingway as well, who seemed to glorify blood sports, whether it was bullfighting or catching big fish. I've also seen those photographs of Hemingway and the marlin. And there's one in particular that I find really gruesome where he's standing in front of like five or six that have been strung up. And these creatures are enormous. They're much bigger than a man. And of course, we don't see fish like that in the sea anymore because they've all been fished. If you read The Islands in the Stream by Hemingway, there is a catch scene early on with similar type of fishermen and a father and a son. And it takes chapters and chapters to catch this fish. So I did look at that. So Hemingway was my go-to person initially.
And whilst there is obviously the reflection on ecological destruction and otherness and jealousy, there is also some wonderfully malevolent humour provided by your nosy neighbour Priscilla and the venal police chief in the book.
I really like that character Priscilla because I hope she comes across as complicated as well. I mean, don't you think that every village has got the scold, the harridan, the gossip? You know, the person who will always poke their nose into other people's business. So that's true, I don't think, just of the Caribbean, but anywhere in the world, there's someone you don't want looking over your fence. And so she's a bit of an archetype as well. She's like, you're going to marry a fish? What? So she gets some really good lines.
One of the other things that really came through in the book is how in small communities, things like disabilities are very often just taken as a matter of fact rather than a matter of particular note. Reggie is deaf and people accept it because that is part of him. And also Shortleg is called Shortleg because that's what he has. And that's actually quite refreshing from a disabled point of view.
With Reggie, it's set in the 70s and I wanted him to have a sense of solidarity. I wanted him to be quite a political deaf young man who'd met a young Californian private tutor who'd shown him a different way of being with himself. Like, I think it says he doesn't necessarily want to wear a hearing aid. He doesn't want to fit in. He's a poet. He's waiting to go off to a deaf college in America. And at some point, Priscilla says, you know, he's not stupid. He's just deaf. I think definitely my knowledge of the Caribbean is that these things, even race, you know, people are very matter of fact about naming disability and or race or anything that here might be seen as a faux pas or something that we need to be very, very sensitive about.
Monique Rothy, thank you so much for taking us further into the world of the Mermaid of Black Conch, and many congratulations again.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
The Mermaid of Black Conch by Monique Rothy is available in print, ebook, and audio wherever you buy your books.
A gift in your will is a really special way to continue supporting RNIB. Large or small, all gifts can have a huge impact on our services, as our work is vital and our services are needed more than ever. Over a third of the work we do is funded by the generosity of supporters who leave a gift in their will to RNIB. If you leave a legacy, you will make a significant difference to the lives of blind and partially sighted people, so their future is full of opportunity. Creating a will offers you the chance to make sure the people and causes you care about most are supported for years to come. We've made it easier for you to write or update your will with our free, accessible and simple will writing services. To find out more, please call 0303 123 9999 or go to rnib.org.uk/legacy.
You're listening to a Costa Book Award special edition of Read On. Since the Book of the Year Prize was introduced in 1985, it's been won 12 times by a novel and 5 times by a first novel. And the Costa debut award-winning novel in contention this year is Love After Love by Ingrid Persaud, which the judges described as an exuberant, outstanding novel teeming with life, full of unforgettable characters and written with such brio and style. Ingrid joined me to tell me more.
Love After Love is a story of an unconventional family, Betty, a widow, her young son Solo, and their lodger, Mr. Chayton. And they form an unusual bond until one night when a secret is revealed and it shatters them. And the rest of the story is really about how they sort of find themselves and each other. It's set in Trinidad and it's written in Trinidadian dialect, which we can talk about a bit later. But yeah, that's kind of what it's about.
And it is very much about how love also can have a dark side and how it's the trials and tribulations of relationships that forge our feelings. I suppose a bit like Trinidad being a beautiful island paradise with some underlying dark aspects to it.
And just to be clear, we're not talking about love in the romantic sense, which is the sort of love that is privileged in so much literature. This is love across the board, different types of love, love for family, love for friends, love for one's child. And throughout the novel, these types of loves are tested and often found wanting.
Yes, it's not too much of a spoiler to say that the supposed romantic love match between Betty and her husband Sunil turns sour very early on, and probably the most important relationship she has with a man outside her immediate family is with Mr. Cheetan, with whom she has no romantic attachment.
Yes, and it's not too much of a spoiler either to say that it's not for want of trying that they don't have a romantic relationship. But it soon becomes apparent that, you know, Mr. Cheetan is gay. And so Betty perhaps went knocking on the wrong door. But if I could go back to what you said earlier about failure of romantic love between Betty and her husband, Sunil. The book opens with really the only sort of terrible scene of domestic violence. And in a sense, I kind of wanted to just get it out there, done and dusted. The book doesn't dwell on violence, nor is it voyeuristic. This is what's happened. And you need to kind of absorb this information and move on, understanding this is Betty's experience of romantic love. And how really feisty and open-hearted she is as she moves through her life trying to love again in so many ways and to trust.
Yes, and the man she can trust most is actually a colleague, which I think is something that will resonate with a lot of people, just how close we can be to the people that we work with sometimes.
Absolutely. In pre-pandemic times, we spent a great deal of our lives with our work colleagues in close proximity. Now we're doing so remotely. And it's a sort of protected space where relationships aren't exposed to the same battering that they would outside of that protected space. So hence why people perhaps have lots of affairs maybe with people from work. These people seem far more attractive because they're just not subjected to the same requirements that you would ask of someone outside of that space.
Whilst we're talking about work, you are a great advert for changing your career. You were a law professor and then took a sabbatical and went to the Slade College of Art in London, supposedly just for a short time, and have become a very successful writer since. Clearly, you believe that shaking things up is rather vital to life.
I certainly didn't get here in one straight shot. Definitely the scenic route. I didn't plan it that way. I come from a very simple kind of lower middle class family in Trinidad. And if you're from a quite ordinary Indian family, East Indian background in Trinidad, there are three options. You can be a lawyer, a doctor, or a failure. I chose to be a lawyer because I was, you know, rubbish at sciences. It's simply expected of a bright kid that that's what they would do. In my early 30s, I just paused just to think about life for a little bit. I wanted something creative, and writing was a portable creative outlet. So it's really by chance that I came to writing. I started really with the discipline of writing an essay once a week and publishing it on a blog. And the essay was about living in Barbados and the challenges and joys of it. And that's how the writing grew from a little blog to a novel.
By way of winning both the Commonwealth Short Story Prize and the BBC Short Story Prize with your story, The Sweet Sop.
I've been incredibly lucky in life, in my writing life. I seem to have won the literary lottery in having that story recognised, and kind of the rest is history.
Well, there's a real exuberance to your writing, and no lesser person than Marlon James, who won the Booker Prize a few years ago, has said you write in the most electrifying prose that you'll read this year, which is quite an accolade. And you bring it brilliantly to life by narrating Love After Love yourself.
So that was not something that was planned either, but I felt quite precious about the audio version. It's in a Trini voice. I'm obviously Trini. And I just thought that very arrogantly that I would be able to bring out the nuances and the dialect and the cadence perhaps better than an actor. And that arrogance landed me in Strathmore Studios in Clerkenwell for 4 very, very long days, regretting I'd ever been so arrogant to say I'd do it. It's tough work narrating a novel.
Well, you've given yourself an enormously tough task by having 3 narrative voices in Betty, Mr. Cheetham, and Betty's son Solo, all of whom are quite distinct. Professional narrators would struggle with that.
Well, I don't sort of try too hard to be so different. I quickly worked out what sort of sound, there were 2 men, so obviously they had to be a little bit different. So I kind of worked out what they might sound like. And then obviously for Betty, I just raised the pitch a little bit higher for a woman and just kind of did my best. But narrating is relentless. It is work that must be extremely accurate. Obviously, those that are listening want to know that the novel they're listening to is word perfect, that they're not being given anything that's second rate. And yeah, it was tough work. I wouldn't want to do that as a profession.
Betty! Betty!
He didn't need to shout. I was already behind the car, opening the trunk to find the lunch cooler. I took it out carefully, along with his newspaper and jacket. Sunil stood waiting as I walked past the driver's door. His swift, sharp kick in my shin was half expected.
Slow coach, you can't come when I call you? What, you're ugly and you're deaf?
Upstairs, I rushed to heat up his food. He was already stinking of rum, but the first thing he did was get a fat glass and open a bottle of white oak.
Ingrid Persaud, narrating her novel, Love After Love. So, are you a fan of audiobooks yourself?
I am, and I've come to audiobooks rather late in life, possibly because, like many people, I had a misconception about audiobooks. I'm an old-fashioned reader. I don't have a Kindle. I don't read on any screen. I like old-fashioned books you hold in your hand, you smell the texture of the book. Those things are important to me. And so I chug books along with me wherever I'm going. And I stumbled across an article praising audiobooks and saying when you listen to an audiobook, the same parts of your brain are lighting up as when you read it. There's no less cognition. In fact, there may be a bit more cognition because you cannot break concentration because then you've missed something and you'd need to go back. So I started having one book that's a physical book that I'm reading at any one time and an audiobook which I carry around with me on my phone. And that's been how I've been consuming books. Particularly during this past year when we've been locked away from family and friends and something about listening to another voice, I found less lonely.
Many writers have found it quite difficult to write during lockdown. Have you been able to? Is there a second novel on its way?
So I'm definitely working rather slowly on a second novel. But during lockdown, the previous 2, I actually found myself turning to a different set of writing. I've been writing children's stories. They're not necessarily going to be for public consumption, but they were just a way of exploring a different sort of writing, shorter, often more optimistic writing, slightly less sophisticated. And that's kind of what's got me through lockdown. It's very interesting. I don't know if I'll keep this up as a quiet little thing that I do on the side. But yes, I've come out of lockdown with several children's stories.
Well, I will keep my fingers crossed to hear more about them in the future. But in the meantime, we have the wonderful exuberance of Love After Love to enjoy. Ingrid Persaud, thank you so much for coming onto the show and many congratulations on winning the Costa First Novel Award.
Thank you very much for having me.
Love After Love by Ingrid Persaud is out now in print, ebook, and audio wherever you buy your books. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. The Costa Book of the Year Award has been won 8 times by a biography. Last time was last year for Jack Fairweather's book, The Volunteer, the true story of the resistance hero who infiltrated Auschwitz. The Costa Biography Award has been won by Lee Lawrence for his memoir, The Louder I Will Sing, a story of racism, riots and redemption that the judges said is both acutely timely and extremely important. It's written from the heart and, as we'll hear, Lee narrates parts of the audiobook version himself.
If you Google Brixton, you might think the area marked on the map looks a bit like a human heart. There was a perception back then, particularly from people who'd never been to Brixton, that it was dangerous. But that was never my experience at all. It wasn't a suburb with white picket fences, for sure. You had to have your wits about you, and there was gang culture. But it's easy to judge gang culture when you're in a world where you're respected and have easy access to opportunities. What Brixton had when I was growing up was community spirit. It takes a village to raise a child, and Brixton was the village that raised me. It was a culture infused with a Rastafarian influence.
Lee, welcome to Read On, and many congratulations on the Costa Award.
Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be here. So the book essentially is about a relationship between a mother and a son. It's also about a terrible injustice where my mum was shot, wrongfully shot by the police back in 1985, which sparked the second wave of Brixton uprisings. And there was no justice in terms of what happened to my mum. As a result of that shooting, she was left paralysed and confined to a wheelchair for the next 26 years of her life. I became a carer. A young carer. I was 11 years old at the time when I witnessed the incident. And it really talks about Brixton before the incident. It goes into the incident, the huge impact that that incident had on my mum and our family life as we knew it. And when my mum passed in 2011, it deals with what we had to go through and what we had to do to finally get recognition and some accountability for what happened to my mum in the end. So although it's a story about this terrible injustice and what we went through, it's also a story of hope. And we're hoping that people will be inspired by this very personal story about overcoming this tragedy.
And the portrait we begin the book with is of your mother dancing before the shooting. I was very much struck that the book is not about the legal battle so much as it's about the emotional battle that you as a family then had to go through for the next quarter of a century, which really only starts to be resolved when your mother dies and the hospital doctor asks for an inquiry because he realizes that the fragments of the bullet lodged still in her spine actually have caused her death 26 years later.
That's correct. My mum's always been known as this person who was shot by the police in front of her children. And through the book, I wanted to convey that she was a lot more than that. She meant a lot more than that to us. And I wanted to bring her character alive. Who was she before the incident? What she was like as a person, so that people can connect to my mum's personality, as well as how she dealt with this ordeal. And she's always been my biggest inspiration and my hero. And the book, for me, is a way of allowing others to see her in the light that I saw her, because the way she dealt with that, we followed suit. So when people look at me today and say, you know, Lee, how did you come through that? You know, witnessing such a horrific incident at 11, how did you cope with that? And I'll always attribute that to my mum, because the way she dealt with it, as I said to you, she was the example and we just followed her lead, basically.
It's a bit of a cliche, but actually it is that thing that bad life experiences either make you bitter or better. And certainly this is a book that is full of hope and the realization that you have to work at hope.
Absolutely. I always say you can't control what happens to you in life, but you certainly can have a hand in how you choose to deal with it. And I saw that again as an example in my mum. And in turn, and especially when my mum passed, I had to really connect with how would she have wanted me to deal with this situation. And throughout that whole process, I had it always at the forefront of my mind. Every decision I made was coming from that space.
And as you say, one of the things that is so important is to present your mother as a person rather than just a victim. And it's that human connection that really powers this memoir, and it's immensely moving. You have also undertaken narrating part of the book yourself, which clearly was something that was very important to you.
Yes, because I suffer with dyslexia, so therefore, although I wanted to do the whole book, it would have been really challenging for me, but I really wanted to have a presence on the audio, and I'm glad that I did. I'm really proud of how the audio version has come out, and it was important for me to have an audio version because that's how I read most books, and there are a lot of people who are not able to read the physical copy but can hear the audio and still be able to enjoy the story.
And could you just explain the title?
So the title comes from a song, Something So Strong by Labi Siffre, and the song itself and the sentiment of the song is very relatable when I think about what we went through. Also, there's a line before which says, the more you refuse to hear my voice, the louder I will sing. And it's my response to what happened when my mum was shot that day. Immediately after, I was screaming and shouting hysterically, and the officer who shot my mum then pointed the gun towards me and said, someone better shut this effing kid up. And the louder I will sing is really a response to that, that no, I will never shut up and I will always continue to speak up, and I want to encourage others to do the same.
The book really reflects just how impactful disability is, not only on the individual, but on those who surround and love them as well. And that's certainly something that you have taken from your experience. You've founded two charities, one of which, Mobility Transport, is specifically designed to help people with disabilities get around.
That's correct. I'm somewhat defined by what has happened to some degree. And I've always been somebody who is probably a natural problem solver. So I looked at what we went through as a family and thought, how can we help others with the insight that we've got now? So transport was a big thing for us. I had to end up transporting my mum around myself because there was no services that we felt like we could rely on at the time. And also my mum wanted to be transported in a dignified manner. So with that in mind, it could be difficult to get her out of the house at the beginning. So therefore, if we was going to do it in a really sensitive way. So that's how Mobility Transport was born. I became a London taxi driver myself. And after doing that for many years and just being out and seeing things for myself and coming into contact with people who were in similar situations as my mum or as we were as a family, and finding that that natural connection of just understanding made a big difference. So that's how we formed the transport company, and that's been going really, really well so far, and it's well received. The charities has a more holistic approach, I would say. We look at people who have been isolated and secluded as a result of their disability, and we look at how we can support carers. And one of our main things that we've been doing over the years is experience days, because we overlook people with disabilities. They get the real basics, you know, getting from A to B, getting to the doctor's appointment. You might be lucky if you get to do some shopping, but in terms of going out and enjoying yourselves and doing things in a social way can be very limiting. So we looked at how can we organize experience days to allow people to have a taste of what's possible and whet their appetite to say, okay, wow, we can do this. We can go to the London Eye. We can go to museums. We can go to the seaside. And it's not as difficult as maybe we think it is in our head. And really being like that first step into helping people to become more independent and more included.
And that charity is actually named after your mum, the Cherry Gross Foundation. And I believe you're also raising money to have a statue built in Brixton to commemorate her as well.
That's right. So We're hoping to have it unveiled on the 24th of April, which will mark 10 years since my mum has passed. And the memorial will signify not only what my mum went through and what she stood for, but it also represents a whole community who stood up courageously for that injustice and continues to support us today.
And how do you think she would feel about your Costa Award?
So I was saying this to someone recently that throughout my journey, people would say, Lee, your mum would be proud and your mum would be proud. And a lot of what I've done so far, I feel like I've been in a reactive space. Things happen and all you're doing is just making decisions around how you can respond to this. Where this process and writing this book has been a labour of love. So it's been a very proactive space, which has been nice. And it's one of those moments where I can really connect with the fact that my mum would be proud. She was an avid reader herself. And yeah, I could only imagine the big smile on her face with pride.
Well, it's a fantastic living memorial to your mother's memory and her example. And Lee Lawrence, thank you so much for taking the time to come onto the show and tell us about your memoir, The Louder I Will Sing.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
The Louder I Shall Sing by Lee Lawrence is out now commercially in print, ebook, and audio.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in Braille so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
This is a special Costa Awards episode of Read On. As with biography, books of poetry have also won the overall Costa Book of the Year Award 8 times. The last was in 2017, when Helen Dunmore won shortly after her death. This year, the Costa Poetry Award has also been presented posthumously to Yvan Boland for her final collection of verse, The Historians. Her friend and publisher, Michael Schmidt, joined me down the line to tell me more about Yvan and her work. Michael, welcome to Read On.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So, can you introduce us to Yvan?
Yvan is a poet who began, as it were, as a very conventional poet in the context of quite a rich period in Irish poetry, which included writers like Derek Mahan, Seamus Heaney in his early years. And she was one of the promising upcoming young poets who soon became rather dissatisfied with the scene as she found it in Dublin. It was quite competitive, and in a curious way, it seemed to exclude, I think, a lot of the experiences she wanted to bring into poetry. And so she began to go her own way, to read well outside the traditions that were surrounding her at the time, and gradually began to take a different direction, an own direction. The poetry that she was writing into was largely male, was largely defined in a sense by the politics of the previous 100 years of Irish history, which is, of course, a very rich and rewarding subject, though a rather horrible period to live through, I suspect. And it was very male in the sense that it seemed to exclude a lot of female experience. As she got married, she had children. She began to think it would be very nice if there was space in my poetry for the experiences I'm having as a woman and as a mother. And so she began to write poetry, which first of all broke with traditional forms, so it is highly formalized, and not formulaic, but formalized. And she began writing with other women. There were other women active, and enabled by them, she began to enable in return. And I think she had a huge impact on Irish poetry, on the emergence of some of the really fine Irish poets. She wasn't alone in this, but she became more or less, I suppose, one of the leaders. And her example spread to England, to America, where she taught for many years at Stanford, and one of the most prestigious of the writing programs there, and from there right across the Anglophone world and then in translation into other literatures. She wrote not only poems, but she wrote wonderful books like Object Lessons, which is a book of essays on being a poet in the world and being a female poet in the world, a critical account really acknowledging the way the world that you live in and belongs to you does have a place in poetry. And so I think it was this wonderful sense of expansion. She was much impacted on by the American poet Adrienne Rich, who felt in her very famous poem, Diving into the Wreck, that it was important for women writers to dive into the wreck of language and, as it were, refloat it, possibly in a different direction with a different crew.
And though she was very widely travelled and spent a lot of time in the United States, that sense of her Irish heritage never left her and infuses her final collection of poetry, for which she's won the Costa Prize. And it's something that was forged very early on in her life, I believe, when her father was posted as a diplomat to London.
Yes, she did spend an awful lot of her childhood and her adolescence outside Ireland. And in a way, there is this absence of an Irish childhood that she's sort of trying to make up for in a lot of the more specific Irish poems. And I would have thought that if one was statistical, probably quite a lot more than half of her life was spent outside Ireland. And this, I think, made her Irishness very special. She wasn't an exile because she always seemed to have a home there, though not until she married a proper home, a house with a family in it. But there was, I think, a great commitment to Ireland, both as an idea and as something she longed for and felt both part of and also not exactly excluded by, but on the margins of.
And she explores Irish history in the round to reanimate women's position within that Irish history.
Yes, but I think more than that, she finds objects, physical objects, which have no history attached to them, but which were tools and so on used by women in their various occasions. And she then imagines the people to whom these things belonged, and she, as it were, infers them from the things that they worked with. There's a sense of rediscovering in things, in objects, the object lessons of that title, the people who have not been written into history. And the historians is really about the people who make history but are written out of it, people who actually keep the society going, bring it its tea and its biscuits, if you like, but then are not seen in the room. There's a marvelous poem she wrote called Margin. Can I read you a little bit of that? It begins with an account of the hawk moth, which fascinates her because it exists in both the west and the south of Ireland. And it seems to slow down in its mind so that at nightfall it can see better than it would otherwise. It can actually slow down its mind and sort of slow down time. And she writes about reflecting on that. She says, I walked on past lighted windows, drawn curtains. It was colder now, and the intimate, unsettled colors showed me up, a transient, a woman dressed for warmth, telling the island to myself, as I always have, so as to see it more clearly. Those lines are wonderful. Telling the island to myself, as I always have, so as to see it more clearly, not the land of fevers and injuries, but the region I found for myself, described for myself in my own language, so I could stand, if only for one moment, on its margin. I love that ending, the kind of pacing of it, and this sort of sense of marginal inclusion, but not real inclusion. Mm. It's a really powerful poem. And I guess that's the kind of history she's on the edge of as well.
Was she also aware that she was approaching the end of her life as she was writing this final collection of verse?
I don't imagine that she did. I mean, most of us who are pushing 70 or more probably realize that the end is not as far away as it was. But I don't believe she had been ill, and I don't believe she was expecting this very sudden end.
And of course, she would have been delighted to know that she had won the Costa Award this year. How do you think she would have celebrated?
I don't think she would have celebrated. She was a woman who had received many honors, and honors are rather different from prizes because honors, you're not competing with anyone necessarily for an honor. You're being given an honor for something you've done. And in a curious way, I don't see the Costa Prize as a prize, but more as an honor, an honor given to an astonishing book. It is an astonishing book. As the Costa people say, it's a book with a tremendous number of brilliant lines in it, you think. And the lines are brilliant not because they sing in the way that Yeats does, but because they speak in the way that, say, Swift or somebody like that would speak, another Irishman who she loved. And so I think she would have probably taken it as a recognition rather than as a kind of thing won or wrested from a race with other poets. I don't think she felt competitive. That was one of the wonderful things about her. She was always enabling other poets. The number of really fine young Irish and other poets, American, that she recommended to me over the 30-odd years that we worked together, it was legion. And she really was a huge enabler rather than a competitor in the field of poetry. I think she'd had enough competition from the poets that she knew when she was young and taking shape in Dublin as a student and then as a young journalist and writer. She'd had enough of that kind of competition. She thought poetry was a shared enterprise, if you like. And I guess that's one of the main feminist things she brought to it.
Well, as the judges say, the collection is packed with the finest lines of poetry that have been written in the 21st century. I know that it's a beautiful hardback and paperback edition. Are there any plans for an audio version?
Not at this stage. We normally do audiobooks when the poet herself or himself is there to read them. We don't usually do actor-read audiobooks. And so it should be done, I think, as an audiobook. It would be wonderful had she read through the whole book and done it for us. But the book was finished by her and was put into press by her. She died before it came to fruition, or we could ask her.
And would listeners be able to access her reading any of the poems, perhaps on YouTube or something like that?
Yes, if you look up Evan Boland online, there is access to quite a few of her poems in audio format, poems that she read in public readings. The famous, the last poem, which she read to celebrate the anniversary of suffrage in the Irish Republic. And those all exist and can be found online.
And to remind listeners, her name is spelt Evan Boland. Well, Michael Schmidt, thank you so much for introducing us to Evan Boland and for talking us through her final collection of poetry and for being a guest on Read On.
A real pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
The Historians by Evan Boland is out now in print and ebook. The Costa Book of the Year Award has only been won by a children's book twice before. In 2015 by Francis Harding for The Lie Tree and by Philip Pullman for The Amber Spyglass in 2001. And the winner of this year's Costa Children's Book Award is The Voyage of the Sparrowhawk by Natasha Farrant, which judges described as a modern classic that is pure heavenly escapism. Natasha Farrant, welcome to Read On.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And very many congratulations on winning the Costa Children's Book Award this year.
Thank you. A lovely, lovely thing to happen so early in the new year. Very nice way to see in 2021.
So can you introduce us to The Voyage of the Sparrowhawk?
So The Voyage of the Sparrowhawk follows the fortunes of two orphans, Lottie and Ben, in the aftermath of World War One, and for one reason or another, they both have to leave the unspecified sleepy little town in England that they live in and make their way on a perilous journey across the Channel to France, where they may be able to find people who can help them. And they make the journey with an increasing number of dogs on a narrowboat called the Sparrowhawk, which, as anybody who's ever been on a narrowboat knows, narrowboats are not made for the open sea.
And Ben is an orphan. He was adopted by a man along with another boy called Sam, who went off to fight in the First World War. And when the man who adopted them went to visit Sam, who was injured in France, that man was killed in a bomb explosion.
Since then, Sam, the brother, has disappeared, and there's been no news about him since the day of the explosion. But Ben's completely convinced that his brother is still alive, and that's what's sort of driving him all the way through the plot.
And he's also escaping from the interests of the authorities, who don't think that a young boy should be living by himself on a narrowboat.
absolutely. So, yes, both Lottie and Ben are trying to escape the interest of her uncle and the authorities, who probably quite rightly feel that a 12-year-old shouldn't live alone on a narrowboat, especially if he's stopped going to school.
And Lottie, as you say, is trying to escape from her uncle and aunt, who really are pretty horrible people and only interested in the house that she's inherited after her parents have died in a plane crash.
Yes. I was very careful not to make them caricatures, but they are sort of almost like your stereotype children's book villains, and all they're interested in is Lottie's house and Lottie's money, because actually Lottie is in fact fabulously wealthy, but of course only being 12 years old, completely at the mercy of her guardian, who is her uncle, and who is actually spectacularly cruel to her, and I think not in a caricatured way. I'm more and more incensed, actually, by the way some grown-ups treat children, grown-ups who should have a care, a duty towards children, and who abuse those duties. And her uncle is exactly that. Although he could be constructed as a stereotypical villain, he's actually, unfortunately, very sadly, there are too many people in the world like that who don't take their responsibilities to children seriously. And Lottie, I think, is perfectly justified in trying to make a better life for herself by running away from him, which she does in quite spectacular fashion on several occasions.
She is a terrifically feisty character who really is a model of resilience, I think, especially for these times that we're living through at the moment, where it's very easy to say, oh, life is absolutely terrible. The perspective of history shows that the world has been through more terrible times in the past, and actually it is the resilience of young people often that pulls us through.
Yeah, isn't it interesting as well? How, you know, I started writing this book a long time before any of us knew that COVID-19 even existed. And yet, what you've just said, I think it often. Well, A, you know, we're living through terrible times, but let's keep a sense of perspective here. First World War was infinitely more terrible, and indeed the pandemic that followed was so much worse. But yeah, Lottie has turned out to be, I think, my favourite character that I've ever written. And she has this line that she repeats several times through the story, which is that we can do anything. And in fact, rather nicely, she says to Ben, you know, together we can do anything. Because Lottie is, as you say, the sort of feisty firecracker of a character, where Ben is sort of more measured and more thoughtful. And as Lottie says, the two of them together can do anything. She has these sort of wild ideas and this sense that there are no limits. And he sort of quietly puts them into motion. So they're a perfect partnership. But yeah, that sense of just never, ever giving up and playing the cards you've been dealt and playing them triumphantly to your own advantage. I think she's a model for us all, really.
And their friendship really does grow, not just out of a mutual need to conquer the situation that they find themselves in, but actually through recognising that each of them brings something to that fight. I think they both recognise their limitations.
Yes, I think there are two things actually in their friendship. One is that they come from very different backgrounds. You know, Lottie is the daughter of fabulously rich parents and lives in this grand house. And Ben is an orphan who's rescued from an orphanage by a penniless man who lives on a narrowboat. But they both recognize the intense loneliness that they both suffered in early life. And they both know love, of course, because Ben's adoptive father is extremely loving. And Lottie's parents, who died when she was 8, are also extremely loving. They both known love, lost love, known intense loneliness, and recognised that in each other. Yes, they sort of complete each other. So it turns into a truly beautiful friendship.
I thought it was also rather clever how you made the two of them parents in some way. Parents to the dogs that they both own. And, well, without giving too much of a spoiler, to the litter of puppies that turned up.
Make them grandparents. Yeah, well, they create their family, don't they? They are a family of, yeah, two children, two dogs, and, well, as I think it says on the back, a growing number of dogs. And actually the whole book really is about people finding family and home. It's an important message in this time as well. I suppose just to find what really matters, find your center of gravity again and rebuild on that basis.
And those are themes that you've explored before in your other books, many of which are available in Braille and as talking books from the R&IB Library. And I believe that the day after your Costa success, you sold the rights for the audiobook version of Voyage of the Sparrowhawk.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So I'm not sure when that's going to be available, but hopefully that will be available for the RNIB library soon.
And you must be delighted that you can reach an audience of print disabled people through audiobooks and also increasingly through ebooks that can be turned into e-braille.
Yes, it's wonderful to feel that it's accessible to everybody.
And in the meantime, as a special treat to our listeners, you've kindly agreed to give us a reading from Voyage of the Sparrowhawk.
Yeah, so I've chosen just a very short passage, but from the close to the beginning of the book, and it's when Lottie comes to the Sparrowhawk, Ben's narrowboat, for the first time. And so the two children are on the narrowboat, and it's late afternoon, it's the beginning of spring, they're standing on deck. And Ben is very proudly showing his boat to Lottie. It was approaching the time of day Ben loved best, when mist hovered over the water and the sun's sinking rays touched the dirty canal with gold. Ben felt a quiet glow of pride as Lottie caught her breath. "It's even better from the roof," he offered. He stepped onto the storage box and hoisted himself lightly onto the roof, then turned and held out his hand. Lottie glanced at her watch, then climbed after him. "Oh," she cried. "Oh, you're right." The sun sank, the shadows lengthened, the gold of the water deepened. Ben and Lottie sat with the dogs between them and forgot about everything else. It never failed, this magic of the world seen from the roof of the boat. "When I was little, we used to go on holiday to my grandmother's house in France," said Lottie at last. "Papa kept a little rowing boat in the boathouse by the river. I always thought when we went out in it how different everything looks from the water. Like everything is possible, you know, that you're completely free to go anywhere you want. Is that what it's like living on the Sparrowhawk?" "Yes," said Ben, "that is exactly what it's like."
It really is a roller coaster of an adventure.
That was a fun scene to write, I have to say.
Natasha Farren, thank you so much for reading from your Costa Award winning book, Voyage of the Sparrowhawk, and for being a guest on Read On.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
The Voyage of the Sparrowhawk is out now in print and ebook, with that audiobook version on its way soon. So that's all five titles in contention for the 2020 Costa Book of the Year Award. And hopefully Read On has left you pondering the result, even as the judges are doing the same. We'll make sure to bring you their decision in next week's show, along with more book news, reviews, and author interviews. If you can't wait that long, don't forget that we're always available as a podcast. Simply search your chosen provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And you can always follow us on Twitter. I'm at RedSale, which is RedSzell, and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_Books. Thanks to all my guests, to producer Hannah, and to all of you for listening. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.